If you would, turn in your Bibles to Joshua chapter 9. Joshua chapter 9. I was surfing the internet and I came across a poster. There's a lot of neat things on the internet, and one of my favorite things to do, as some of you may have figured out if you look at many of my PowerPoints, is I like to surf Google Images. There's just some neat stuff out there that you can use in PowerPoints. And so I came across this one. It is a poster about deception. And I don't know if you can see it very well there, but it's basically this poster. It's got a picture of a subway stop. You can see there to kind of stop on the walkway. You've got the tracks there, and then you've got a billboard. It's on the back wall of the subway. Now, if you can read what it says, it says, "Come a little closer." Can you kind of see that on the big white sign on the back wall? Well, you can't really tell it, but down at the bottom, it turns out that billboard is for a funeral services development company. Now, I want you to think about what they're saying. Here's a company with a billboard, and they do funeral services, and so they've got a sign on the other side of a railroad track, or in this case of a subway, and the sign says, "Rush, come a little closer." Now, some of you will get that about halfway through the lesson, and I don't think any of our funeral homes would do that, and I hope nobody did. I hope this is staged, and nobody would actually do that. But that's deception, isn't it? I want you to think about, as you think about that picture, and I want you to think about that idea of trying to entice people to step on the railroad track so they'll get run over and they can get some funeral business, I guess is the idea. I want you to realize that deception is real. And I want you to realize that deception is dangerous. And sometimes deception can even be deadly. Tonight we're going to look at a chapter that's all about deception. We're focusing on Joshua chapter 9. And in Joshua chapter 9, you, in my opinion, have a fascinating story. I continue to be amazed at the things that are going on in the book of Joshua. If you made up a book about people and the things they did in taking a land, you could not make it more interesting than these real live events that happened in the history and the story of the nation of Israel. So let's take a few moments tonight and let's look at Joshua chapter 9. We're looking at the events after they stopped, as we talked about this morning, at Shechem in between Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. They renewed their covenant relationship with God. Now what you're going to find is throughout the book of Joshua, in fact, throughout Israelite history, usually, not long after they had periods where they emphasized their spirituality, they emphasized their relationship with God, they emphasized their covenant with Him, pretty soon thereafter, there often came a period of testing. And it happens again here. Joshua 9, the deception, follows Joshua chapter 8. Now, as we look at this, and as we think about some points to ponder from Joshua chapter 9, I want us to use the letter D as our memory glue. And as we look at this, I want us to think about the decision, the deception, and the desertion. The decision, the deception, and the desertion as we focus on Joshua chapter 9. All right? So let's start off, let's dive in, and let's look at the decision. If you would read with me just the first verse and a half, I guess it is, of Joshua chapter 9. "Now it came about when all the kings who were beyond the Jordan in the hill country and in the lowland and on the coast of the great sea beyond Lebanon, the Hittite and the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusites heard of it, that they gathered themselves together with one accord to fight with Joshua and with Israel." Now I want you to think about what's going on here. First of all, we have a little bit of a task ahead of us. Because we have to figure out, as best we can, or we'll make an educated guess, at what it is. What I'm talking about when I say we've got to figure out what it is, I want you to notice that at the end of verse 2, or verse 1 it says, it talks about all these different nations that are within the region of Canaan. Remember, the land of Canaan is a land that God is giving to His people. And it says, when they heard it they made some decisions. Well, what is the it? What is it they heard about? It could be that they had heard about what God had done for Israel. That is consistently mentioned throughout this book. For example, think about when the spies went to Jericho and went into Rahab's home. What did she say? We heard of what your God did when He delivered you from the Egyptians. We heard of what you did to the two great kings, the Amorite kings on the other side of the Jordan River. And based on what we heard, she said, our hearts melted. Now you're going to go to the beginning of chapter 10 and you're going to hear about another group of people, and it says they heard some things. They heard about what God had done. They heard about some decisions that were made in this very chapter we're about to look at. So a lot of rumors are circulating. And I find it kind of interesting, to be honest with you, because as you think about this, remember, they didn't have the internet. They didn't have television. They didn't have radio. If a rumor was spread, it was spread by foot or hoof. In other words, somebody had to get on an animal and ride somewhere many miles away, or somebody had to walk somewhere many miles away. Now, it's interesting that a lot of what they had heard about what God had done had happened a long time ago. Remember, for example, Rahab is going to mention, in fact, the Gibeonites in this chapter are going to mention it, they're going to mention that they heard that God had parted the Red Sea for them. Well, it shouldn't surprise us that that rumor had gotten there, because that happened 38, 40 years before. But then when it talks about the defeat of the Amorite kings on the other side of the Jordan River, that was much more recent history. Yet consistently, town by town and people by people, they had all heard about it. So the rumor mill had been running full bore talking about the Israelites. So you've got all of this stuff circulating around about what Israel is doing and about how God is helping them. And no doubt with that, you also have the knowledge of what had just happened. You not only have the defeat of Jericho, but you have the defeat of Ai. But think a moment. Remember last week we talked about Ai. How was Ai different from Jericho? What happened at Ai for the very first time? Israel had had three straight victories. They defeated the two Amorite kings on the other side of the Jordan. They'd wiped out the powerful city of Jericho. But then what happened at Ai? At Ai, they suffered their first defeat. And so if these nations had heard about that, they're then making decisions on what they're hearing. Remember when the people of Jericho first heard about the power of Israel and Israel's God, their hearts melted. And so what did they do? They stayed behind their walls. What happened? The walls came down, the Israelites came in, and they were wiped out. But what happened when they went to Ai? Did their hearts melt with fear and did they hide behind their walls? No. When Israel attacked Ai, Ai attacked back. Israel ran the first day. And remember, 36 Israelites actually died in battle as they fled the battlefield running from the people of Ai. And this is a small city, a small walled city. Even though Israel eventually won the battle, at least for a day, this small city had won one victory. So my suspicion is that what was happening here is that all of these nations are hearing about what is happening on the battlefield. And they're beginning to put two and two together. You know, when Jericho hid behind their walls, they were defeated. But you know that little town of Ai? They left their walls, they fought back, and they held out for a day. Now, if that little city can do that in one battle for a day, then what if a whole bunch of us get together and we all, a bunch of big city states, attack Israel together? What if instead of just kind of hiding here behind our walls like Jericho did, we take the battle to them? They've just suffered their first defeat. There is hope. Okay, you think about, again, we talked about the sports world this morning. A team wins, say, 27 games in a row. And you think they can't be beaten. But then one team comes along and beats them. And then what happens to the next team? Hey, if they beat them, maybe we can. And so based on what they heard, I believe they're beginning to take courage.
Maybe what they heard is they had just heard about what happened at the end of chapter 8 where they stopped at Shechem between the two mountains, remember, and wrote down the law and read the law. And maybe, you know, sometimes people take spirituality as a sign of weakness. At least there are people like that today. If you choose to live godly in the business world, there are people who will think you're weak because of that. If you choose to come to worship on a Sunday morning instead of going out and working an extra day and getting some extra money or working some overtime, there are some people in the world that will think you're weak. If you go on a business trip and there's a big business luncheon and everybody else is drinking and you decide not to and you decide to drink your tea or water or soda or whatever, there are people that will think you are weak. And so maybe when Israel stopped fighting, they're kind of licking the wounds of a recent, even though they eventually won, but of a recent loss, maybe the neighboring nations took that as weakness. They said, hey, we've got them cornered. They're all stopped in one place, right in the middle of the country. Ai has just beaten them, so now maybe is our chance. And so they made a decision to bond together. You're going to find there were two different coalitions that fought against Israel. One in the northern part of Canaan, one in the southern part of Canaan, that tried to attack them. What I want you to see is, all of these nations and all of these individuals, they're having to make decisions. What are we going to do about Israel? And what are we going to do about Israel's God? And each of them decided in their own way, not always the same way as those before them. Some hid behind their cities. Some gathered up armies and attacked in the open field. And some tried something else. I want you to notice what it says in verse 3. When the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and to Ai, they also acted craftily. Now it's interesting, that stands in contrast to what these other nations are doing. Now it's interesting that of those nations that are gathering together to attack Israel, the Gibeonites are among some of those peoples. In other words, they made a decision not to go along with the crowd. Their nation is gathering the city of states that many times in the ancient world they would have a group of city states that were in an agreement, a covenant together. The Philistine nation always functioned this way. You had five major city states. Each of them had their own separate king, but they all had peace treaties with each other and basically had an agreement that if somebody attacked one of them, all of them fought. Okay? So they're not really all one big nation. They're five separate great cities, but they work in concert with each other. And so that's what's going on with a lot of these other nations that you find mentioned here. But the Gibeonites decided to not go along with the crowd. They decided to take another route. So all I want us to see as we begin is that these nations are having to make decisions. And these are life and death decisions. These are not minor decisions. Will I take this job or that job? Will I buy this dress or this dress? Move in that house or live in that town? These decisions determine whether people live or die. Because this is a time of war. But not only is this about decision, it is about deception. Verse 4 says, they acted craftily and set out as envoys and took worn out sacks on their donkeys and wineskins worn out and torn and mended, worn out and patched sandals on their feet and worn out clothes on themselves, and all the bread of their provision was dry and had become crumbled. They went to Joshua at the camp at Gilgal, and they said to him and the men of Israel, we have come from a far country, now therefore make a covenant with us. Now I want to ask you, do any of you have an old pair of blue jeans that you've worn for years? Anybody have that around their house? I just a little non-scientific observation. Everybody that raised their hand was either a man, a teenager, or a small child. I didn't see any of the ladies raise their hands. That means they either don't or they weren't going to let anybody know about it, right? Okay, my guess is a lot of us, at least us guys, we've got a fishing shirt, or a ball playing shirt, or a pair of work in the backyard blue jeans with more holes than we can count. Or maybe you've got that favorite pair of shoes. Now I brought with me tonight a pair of sandals. I just love these sandals. They're coming all to pieces. I don't know if you can see here, do you like my nice little, it's going to be a new fad. I'm thinking about patenting it. It's having duct tape on your sandals, okay? These are the ones I wear a lot of times when I'm mowing the yard, okay? And they've ripped and they've torn, and I've taped them and I've super glued them, and right now they're super glued and taped because I just haven't found another pair that I like as well. Now my wife is smiling over here because she's told me for a long time she's married to a pack rat, but I'm actually encouraged by today's lesson. Because you never know, someday these shoes could save somebody's life. I want you to think about it. I just want you to picture, hey, we're going to try to save the nation. So we need everybody to pitch in and bring all their old worn-out clothes, all the bread that is ruined in the cabinet, all your worn-out sandals, any sacks with holes in them, and bring them to the city square. And you got to be thinking, the people are saying, what? My wife has been telling me for weeks I need to throw this away. Now you want to do it? Use it to save the nation? And that's what they do. They gather up all their old stuff. The Gibeonites lived generally in the hill country in fortresses not too terribly far from Bethlehem. Much of their land fell in the tribe of Benjamin, though the main city of Gibeon itself belonged to later to the Levite tribe. And so they're not traveling from very far away. But they wanted to look like they came from a long way away. And so what's going on in the story, and you can read through it and look at it in more detail, but basically what they're doing is they're trying to make it look like they live a long way off, but they've heard about Israel and Israel's God. In fact, I want you to notice what it says in verse 9. Your servants have come from a very far country. And then they said, here's why. Because of the fame of the Lord your God. Let me stop for a moment. It sounds a whole lot like Rahab. That's basically the same thing Rahab said. And remember Rahab from Jericho. For we have heard the report of him and all that he did in Egypt and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan. And they're going to say that we traveled a great distance because we heard about the greatness of your God. And because of the greatness of your God, we want to be at peace with you because of your God. Now, you may think we're close at hand, but we're not. In fact, the Israelite leaders in Joshua, they were suspicious. They said, what if you're close by? And they said, oh, we're not close by. And they said, you know, you see this old moldy, crumbled, dried out bread? They said, it was warm. We had just taken it out of the oven when we first started out on this trip. And said, we had these clothes were new and our sandals were new, but we have traveled so far that our clothing has worn out, our bread has crumbled or it's molded. Said, we're not from just down the road, from a long, long way away, and we just have heard about you and your God, and we want to be in a peace treaty with you. The text says that the Israelite leaders looked at their equipment, if you will, looked at their sandals, looked at their bread, looked at their sacks. And you can just almost imagine them talking among themselves. It's obvious these people came from a long way away. Man, did you see that guy's sandals? In fact, I think we need to take up a collection of sandals and give them some sandals to wear back home. You can just kind of imagine the leaders talking about what they've seen. Man, if people are willing to travel this far because of what they've heard about our God, man, the right thing to do is to make a peace treaty with them. That's the least we could do for these folks that would travel so far out of devotion to our God. They don't live just down the road. Why, we don't need to worry about it. I think we ought to make a peace treaty. Can I have a show of hands? The ayes have it. And so they agree to make peace with the Gibeonites. But what's the problem? The problem is found in verse 14. So the men of Israel took some of their provisions and did not ask the counsel of the Lord. Now this is really interesting. Because you remember when we talked about the defeated Ai? What was Joshua's pattern? Joshua's pattern when he went into battle was to get a word from the Lord on what to do and how to do it. When was the last time that we don't think he asked God's advice? It was at Ai. Okay, maybe he did. There is no evidence of it. And in the other attacks, there is evidence that he asked God. So they've just attacked the city of Ai and suffered their first defeat because they didn't ask God. They finally fixed that, won the victory over Ai, have rededicated themselves to a covenant with God. And so what's the first thing they do right after having renewed their covenant with God? They went right back into their old habits. And they made a decision without asking for God's input. The deception worked because they walked by sight and not by faith. But then there's the desertion in the story. If you look at what starts in verse 16, the text says after about 3 days, they found out about the deception. They found out that the Gibeonites were from not far away. And so the text says they literally marched on Gibeah. But they did not destroy them, even though many of the people apparently wanted to. In fact, the people were upset with their leaders for making this decision. But I want you to notice what is found in verse 19. And all the leaders said to the whole congregation, "We have sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel. Now we cannot touch them. This we will do to them, even let them live, so that wrath will not be on us for the oath which we swore to them." Now what they end up doing is they end up going to the people, the Gibeonites, and they say, "We're going to let you live because we gave you our word." And apparently, when they made the peace treaty, there were no conditions. In other words, they didn't put a clause in there that says, "We make this peace treaty with you, assuming you don't live over by Bethlehem." Okay, they apparently just blindly said, "We now live in a peace treaty with you." And generally what that peace treaty meant is not only that you wouldn't attack them, but many times a peace treaty meant that if somebody else attacked them, you would come to their defense and aid. That becomes a very, very big deal in the book of Joshua and actually in the history of the Israelites. And we'll talk about that more in just a few moments. But I want you to recognize that they say, "We're going to keep our agreement. We won't attack you. We will let you live. But you are going to become woodcutters and water carriers for our nations. You're going to become our servants." The Gibeonites are okay with this. Said, "Fine. Okay, I'd rather be a servant." Basically, their idea is, "I'd rather be a servant and live. I'll tote water and stay alive as to keep my pride and be dead." Okay, and that was their philosophy. And what's interesting is the region they're from had some of the best water supplies, and in particular cisterns where water collected anywhere in the land of Canaan. So it's not just arbitrarily they said, "Oh, you're going to be water carriers." The area they lived in was known for being a water collection place. So that's one of the reasons that they became water carriers. So they became their servants, but the message of the leaders to the people was, "We must honor this agreement." Notice what it said in the text. "And now we cannot touch them. This we will do them, even to let them live, so that the wrath will not be upon us." You see, they had just seen, when they tried to attack Ai, what happens when you don't keep your word to God, when you're not faithful to God's ways. And so, having just freshly had to deal with the consequences of not doing what's right, even though they made a mistake, they made an agreement at a time when they should have consulted God, they should have gotten God's input, but they made an agreement. They gave their word, and they said, "We cannot break our word, because if we break our word and harm them, then God's wrath will come down on us." As you think about their willingness not to desert the Gibeonites, I want you to look at this next slide. Some interesting things I find as you look at the history of what happened to this people. First of all, Israel, for the most part, was faithful to this commitment. They would, in chapter 10, defend the people that they just made this covenant agreement with. You're going to find that many years later, God Himself would defend the Gibeonites. You find over in 2 Samuel chapter 21, verses 1 and following, an issue that takes place during the time of David that dates back to the time of Saul. You need to remember that much of the territory that belonged to these Gibeonite states that were in an alliance with each other was in the tribe of Benjamin. And it seems that there was a problem with kind of a residual resentment against these people for deceiving the Israelites. And during the reign of King Saul killed some Gibeonites. And because of that, God brought a curse on Israel that had to be rectified by the death of some of Saul's descendants during the reign of King David. In other words, I want you to see many years later, during the time when they had kings ruling over them, unlike the time of Joshua, God was still saying to the Israelites, you keep your word. You made a commitment to these people. You don't go back on it. And if any of you do, you make it right. I find it interesting that years later, at least the Gibeon, the main city itself, was given to the tribe of Levi. Because if you look in chapter 9 and verse 27, it not only says, on Joshua 9:27, it not only says there that they were to be water carriers and woodcutters, but I want you to notice what it says, for the congregation and for the altar of the Lord. In other words, it's interesting to me that when God allowed the Gibeonites, because of this treaty and because the Israelites gave their word, when God allowed them to live among the Israelites, He exposed them to Himself. He wanted them to know Him. Remember what we talked about this morning? What was the purpose of Israel? They were to be a kingdom of priests, to be mediators, to help the rest of the world know God. And so that is exactly what happened to the Gibeonites. Later during the reign of David, the tabernacle would be at Gibeon and in this particular region. Later on, when Solomon had a vision, remember that vision where God said, you're going to be king, tell me what you want, I'll give you whatever you want. And he says, I want wisdom to rule your people. It happened in this region among these people. One of David's mighty men was a Gibeonite. It's interesting that when you look at the ongoing story of Israel, even though Saul betrayed the Gibeonites, there is no record anywhere in biblical history of the Gibeonites ever betraying Israel and the covenant they made. In fact, if you go to the book of Nehemiah and you look at the list of people who returned from captivity in Babylon and who helped Nehemiah rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, you know what you'll find among them? You'll find among those who rebuilt Jerusalem the Gibeonites. They may have started out as deceivers, but you know, I can't help think of another deceiver, a man named Jacob, who ended up turning out all right. They didn't start out in an honest and good way, but it seems that over time and exposure to God, they became a part of the people of Israel, and they stayed faithful to Israel and faithful to God all the way through the captivity in Babylon, even up to the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. I thought that was important to note, because as we think about this story, we may look at them in a negative light, but the rest of the story says in time they became somebody to emulate. What are some things that we can learn from this story? I think there are all kinds of things we can learn. There are five things that I've listed. First of all, sin. Sin has its consequences. Remember at the beginning of the chapter, all these different kingdoms are gathering together to attack Israel. My guess, the confidence to band together and fight Israel came in large part because of one victory by the people of Ai on one day. Why did that victory happen? It happened because of Achan's sin. Achan and his family are dead and gone, But the people of Israel are still dealing with the consequences of what he chose to do. We're also going to find in chapter 10 that the children of Israel are going to have to go to war just because of this agreement with the Gibeonites. I want us to recognize that while we can get forgiveness of sins, there may be some consequences that go along with that that will follow us the rest of our lives. You see, if I choose to become an alcoholic, if I choose to try drugs, if I choose to commit adultery on my spouse or divorce and break up our marriage, there may be in time where I can renew my relationship with God and I can make changes and I can seek God's forgiveness. But there may be consequences of those decisions that will haunt me the rest of my life. And so the challenge is to not make the wrong decisions in the first place. Number two, I think this story challenges us to walk by faith and not by sight. They went based on what they saw. They looked at the sandals. They looked at the moldy bread. They looked at the worn out clothing. And based on what they saw with their physical eyes, they made a decision. It was the wrong decision. What they should have done is they should have sought God's input. They should have let Him guide their decisions. And I want you to think of how many times in life we make decisions on how it looks to us. Oh, it looks good. Looks like this is a winner. Looks like this will be fun. And we never consult God through the Word and through prayer and through the wise leaders and spiritual people He's provided around us to decide if it's a good thing to do. We just go purely by what looks good, feels good, and sounds good to us. Or at other times we give up and quit and we throw in the towel just because of how it looks, feels, and sounds. When if we'd had more faith and we'd sought the wisdom and counsel of God, we might have made a totally different decision. The fourth thing is that we need to be a people who stand by our word. That when we say we'll do something, do it even if it's to our hurt and detriment. It hurt. It was painful to Israel to keep their word. But God wanted them to be a people who kept their covenants. God kept His covenant with us. It was so painful it cost Him His Son on the cross of Calvary. And finally, I'm reminded of that saying, two wrongs don't make a right. If there was ever a story that's an example of that, it's this. They made a decision that was wrong because they didn't consult God. I don't think God is so upset with them in this story because they made peace with the Gibeonites. I think God is so upset with them because they never asked for His guidance and input. They didn't let Him be the leader. They chose to lead themselves. Their initial response to making a bad decision was, "Let's go attack and kill the Gibeonites. They deserve to die." And they wanted to follow up a wrong with a worse wrong. And think of how many times we do that. Think of how many times sin snowballs. And we follow up something wrong by trying to cover it up. And we lie and we become more deceptive. We don't want the others to find out. And so we do more and more things that are wrong to cover up the first thing that is wrong. Remember, be people of our word, people of honesty. Two wrongs never make a right. Will you take out your songbooks and turn to the hymn of encouragement? As we think about this story and we think about the Gibeonites and we think about the people that surround them, I want us to remember that they all had to make a decision. They had to make a decision about what they were going to do about their relationship with the God of Israel. All of us have to make the same decision. Because we've heard of what God did. We didn't hear it the same way they did. We heard it through our Bibles. So what are we going to do about it? Now, we don't have to be deceptive to make a peace treaty with God. We don't have to wear old worn-out sandals. We don't have to do what we can to deceive God. God knows everything we've done. We cannot deceive Him anyway. What He wants us to do instead of being deceptive, to be in a peace treaty with Him, He wants us to be honest. He wants us to honestly come to Him and say, I am a sinner. I am unworthy of being in a relationship with You. You are the God of God and the King of kings, and I want You to be the Lord of my life. I admit my sin. I confess my faith in Your Son. I will turn away from my sin with Your help. And I want to be baptized into the name of Your Son to have my sins washed away. No deception, just total honesty and giving of self to God. If you'll do that tonight, then you'll be in a peace treaty with God. And He never breaks His treaties. The rest of your life you can live with a hope you never had before, knowing that no matter what you face, you're on God's side. For those of us who have been in a treaty with God, but we recognize we've not honored the agreement, He still loves us. He'll still take us back. He'll still forgive us. If we'll just quit hiding and deceiving ourselves and others and confess it to Him. If it's something that this is an opportune time to do that, I pray that you'll have the courage to do it right now as we stand and sing.